This podcast contains descriptions of alcohol and drug abuse, sexual assault, adult themes, violence, and explicit language. Listener discretion is advised. On June 3rd, 2011, a young woman named Lauren Spear disappeared after a night out with friends at Indiana University, never to be seen again. As a fellow IU student who grew up with similar circumstances, her story has haunted me. There were so many nights my friends and I could have ended up like her. This is the story about what happened that fateful night at a historic university and a quaint Midwest town with a hidden dark side. This is Finding Lauren. In February 2020, a study was published by the Statista Research Department that projected about 253,000 women under the age of 21 went missing the previous year. This means that at any given time, there are tens of thousands of Americans categorized as missing by law enforcement. However, only a fraction of those individuals receives news coverage. That ratio is in your favor if you are a white female. There is a term used by social scientists and the media to describe the disproportionate media attention that missing white women experience in comparison to missing women of color, known as missing white woman syndrome. Originally coined by PBS News anchor Gwen Ifill, missing white woman syndrome is defined as white women occupying a, quote, privileged role as violent crime victims in news media reporting. In addition to race and class, factors such as supposed attractiveness, body size, and youthfulness function as unfair criteria in the determination of newsworthiness and coverage of missing women. Many people have cited this when talking about Lauren Spearer, as she fits the build of a white, petite, and attractive young female. However much coverage Lauren has received, though, the conversation surrounding her has dimmed, and we still have no answers. During the time that Lauren Spearer went missing, Bloomington was undergoing major construction, with new buildings being developed in the downtown area where Smallwood Plaza and the five North townhomes were located. There were constantly workers around and large vehicles driving in and out at very early hours. This was another big theory of what could have happened, especially if the boys with Lauren were not responsible. There was a lot of speculation that someone in the area might have seen her walking home and taken advantage of her condition. Here is a clip of Sean Cohen of the Journal News and private investigator Bo Deedle discussing possible theories.
Do you believe that there's just some random person that walked up during her short walk home?
Wide open with that. Wide open with the fact that could it have been when she got to College Avenue, some local yokel there was passing by, sees a beautiful young girl there, and all of a sudden, oh, let me give you a lift, get into the car. And is that wide open? Absolutely. That's what I'm saying is nothing is eliminated.
So in all the stuff that you have gone at, it's interesting to me that you still keep that theory open. In other words, you found nothing really to eliminate any of these kids.
Right, and we have some bits of evidence I'm not going to talk about that we're analyzing as we're speaking right now with DNA to try to find out certain things, and that can open up another direction. But my theory is everything's on the table. Could it have been, we checked that guy who's wanted for a couple of murders over there about 200-300 miles away, and that came out to be nothing to do with it. We also had some other informations of some other colleges nearby that there were some people out there. Who's to say, too, is that you didn't have some local nuts there that knew if you go out on a Thursday, Friday, or Saturday night, you were going to find some drunk gals walking in the street. You find someone at 2:30 in the morning, how easy it's going to be. You know she's going to be probably have drunk something, and that could be a theory. Or these boys, would it be just great if we had full cooperation from all the boys, no lawyers, full cooperation, take polygraphs, everybody, and eliminate them? We don't have that, so I can't eliminate nobody.
On June 15th, 2011, the Bloomington Police Department released a photo taken from surveillance footage of a white pickup truck that was seen circling downtown Bloomington in the area that Lauren went missing. The truck, a white short bed four-door Chevrolet Silverado or Colorado built in the mid-2000s, had distinctive wheels and writing on the side. Hundreds of tips were called in as response to the white truck. Bloomington Police Captain Joe Qualter said the truck, which ran a stop sign, did not slow down enough for investigators to be able to make out the writing seen on one of its back doors and rear panels. After this footage was released, a tip was called in regarding an ex-convict, James McClish. McClish had just been released from prison for assaulting his ex-wife and drove a similar white truck. A woman from his past reached out and said he might be worth looking into as he supposedly made comments along the lines of, you know what happened to her? The same thing could happen to you. The woman alleged McClish killed Lauren and then buried her on a farm in southern Indiana. Despite these claims, McClish agreed to take a polygraph test administered by former New York Police Detective Ralph Neves and answered all questions concerning Lauren's disappearance calmly and truthfully. He stated he had nothing to do with her disappearance, and according to the polygraph, it appeared he was being truthful. Another man, known for sexual deviance and convicted of flashing women in the Bloomington area named Justin Wagers, was also searched concerning Lauren's disappearance. He was also the owner of a white pickup truck. Acting on a tip, an FBI spokesperson said that agents and dogs searched the former home of the 35-year-old Martinsville resident in January 2016. Martinsville is just 30 miles north of Bloomington and, as mentioned, has a very high crime rate. Despite his known tendencies towards threats and violence, as well as explicit sexual behavior, Wager's family believes he had nothing to do with Lauren's disappearance. The details of the search warrant for Wager's home will remain sealed unless criminal charges are filed. Both the FBI and Bloomington police said authorities will not release information about the search. It is also unclear whether he has been officially ruled out or not. I'm sure there are many more leads regarding a white truck that haven't been publicized, knowing the nature of the Bloomington Police Department. I also know the private investigators are still actively working on leads they did not disclose to me, but the white truck is a big clue. My friends and I would spend hours looking at these photos trying to find meaning. What was most chilling about them is if you look closely enough, it honestly looks like it could be the silhouette of a person in the back. Maybe it's nothing more than your mind playing tricks on you, or you wanting to so badly figure out what happened that you convince yourself you see something. But it truly did look like there was a person in the back. The back was full of equipment, so it was hard to decipher. But the black and white photo shows what looks like a light-haired figure in a white shirt with arms spread in a compromising position as if trying to dismantle themselves or escape. It also looks like there could potentially be another person behind her with an arm around her mouth. It was cryptic.
The white truck, I remember when we all saw it, we were like, that's it. Like, that's obviously, and it's crazy that they don't have any leads or any real information, or at least that, like, the public knows.
A notorious biker gang called the Sons of Silence were known to roam the streets of Indiana as a new type of mafia. Some tips were reported regarding a former member of the group, Robert Strange, aka Bo Dean, known as the Enforcer. A relative of Strange claimed that he shot and killed Lauren over a dispute about money owed for drugs and buried her on his property. It was rumored that Lauren had met some of the members at the Indy 500 and was doing drugs with them and owed them money after that. I never took this rumor seriously because when you go to the Indy 500, you usually bring everything you need with you to ensure a good time, drugs and alcohol included. At least we did when we went the following summer. Strange denied all allegations. There are also a lot of people who openly dislike him and that would love to pin something like this on him. The only thing that remotely makes me think that this could be plausible is when I think back to all the drugs being passed around campus, and I always wondered where they came from. The sheer volume was astounding. I remember seeing kids holding what looked like pillowcases full of Xanax sticks, but we were just so happy to have whatever we wanted that we didn't think twice. Could it be this biker group was helping to move narcotics around campus? Maybe they were working with some of the boys to push product. If Lauren suffered an overdose at the 5 North townhomes and the boys have never come forward to this day, maybe the reason is they know the ties to this violent gang and were scared for their own lives about divulging any information that could tie back to them. A problem in all these theories floating around is that many of the people reporting the tips have ulterior motives, and time is wasted pursuing these false leads. Whether it be an opportunity to shine negative attention on an enemy, the reward money, or shave a few years off a prison sentence, a lot of the theories about Lauren's disappearance were dead ends. Part of that has to do with the overwhelming media attention that Lauren and the case have received. On the other hand, there are hints of truth in almost everything rumored as well, so it makes things difficult to completely rule anything out. Another largely publicized tip came in from an inmate at the Indiana State Prison and former IU star athlete Corey Hammersley. Hammersley fell hard into the Indiana drug scene, and a year after Lauren disappeared, had a public meltdown in which he ran into the street naked with a gun and fired shots at a house and ultimately police, which earned him a 24-year sentence. Allegedly, Corey Hammersley and a fellow inmate were playing cards together when a clip of Lauren was seen on TV. Hammersley boasted that he knew the guys who were responsible. The inmate spoke anonymously to ABC and recalled that Hammersley said, "They were drinking and doing ecstasy. She OD'd. It scared them. They didn't know what to do with her, and they took her down to the Ohio River, got rid of her body." Hammersley was questioned further on this. However, he recoiled and went on to state to the investigators that he wanted nothing to do with the situation and was not involved. Whether this was an attempt by both inmates to flex their muscles or shave off some prison time, the only reason to me that it holds any weight is that it continues to support the idea that maybe Lauren never left the 5 North townhomes that night. If there is any truth to what Hammersley said, why would he recant and deny his statement? What would he be scared of? The following is retired New York Police Detective Bill Clark.
By being a rat in a prison culture, you're not flexing. You're putting your life in jeopardy. So, I mean, the thing is, they only do it in an effort to help themselves. So while you're in a cell with a guy for 2, 3, 4 years, and, you know, he thinks you're in there because you raped some 4-year-old girl or some shit, and you're proud of the fact that, all right, but I fucking killed some fucking douchebag who raped some friend of mine or some, you know, that they talk, you know, you, when you're constantly around somebody, you know, you confide them, you just have conversations. That's why they do it sometimes.
Then there was a theory about serial killer Israel Keyes. Israel Keyes was an American serial killer, rapist, arsonist, and bank robber. Keyes admitted to violent crimes as early as 1996 with the violent sexual assault of a teenage girl in Oregon. He committed a long series of rapes and murders until his capture in 2012. He died by suicide in 2012 while in custody, awaiting trial for the murder of Samantha Koenig. Keyes planned murders long ahead of time and took extraordinary action to avoid detection, which would fall in line with Lauren's reported timeline. Unlike most serial killers, Keyes did not have a victim profile. He usually killed far from home and never in the same area twice. It was said that after he attacked his last victim, Samantha Koenig, he traveled from Alaska to Chicago, passing through Indiana. Though killers usually have what is known as a cooling off period, especially for someone as meticulous as Keyes, it is highly possible that he stumbled upon Lauren on his route to Chicago, and this was a crime of pure opportunity. However, due to his suicide, we will never have more information on his other crimes and if he had any relation to what happened to Lauren. It also feels like to pin this on Israel Keyes would be too perfect, and everything would have to line up just right. Here is Dr. Robin Stern again.
Guilt has a bad reputation, and it doesn't need to. Guilt can be a very important pro-social emotion. It means that something's wrong, you feel like there's something wrong with something you did. And it causes you to, hopefully, to take a step back and look at what happened, how you behaved, what you might have said, and think, gee, was that okay? Would I have done that again? Do I feel good about it? And sometimes you say yes. And so you've done the pro-social thing of revisiting a decision you made that affects you and someone else. And you said, I still feel good about it. But sometimes when you look back, you think, I don't feel good about that. And I want to do something about that. And whether that means repairing a relationship or apologizing or making a decision for yourself that you are not going to do that again, it can be very healing in a relationship to go back as a result of feeling guilt. I wonder what people who did have a secret, or if people had a secret the day after Lauren's disappearance and felt guilty, what they did with that guilt, whether that guilt caused them to pause and think, do I feel good about that? Is there anything that I would do differently? We would certainly hope that anyone who had any information would feel that they didn't do the right thing withholding the information and at some point would come forward with it. Certainly, if there were more than just information that people are withholding, that they would come forward. But it's hard to imagine that in the entire group of people that Lauren was with, no one woke up the next day with a feeling of guilt. And if they did, we would also hope that whatever it was that they felt was not okay, even if it was letting their friend go home drunk or not taking better care of a friend who could get into trouble on her way home and insisting that she sleep over or insisting that she not go alone, maybe they will ever do that again. We could hope for that because you can't go back and redo Lauren's night. But each one of these people is moving forward in their own life with other opportunities to make similar choices or not.
I also heard a combination of theories related to drug rings expanding so large that it could potentially involve law enforcement or high-powered individuals in Indiana who are using their influence to keep things quiet. This idea could explain why the police have been so hesitant to share information in the case of Lauren, especially given the fact that we know the state of Indiana received a demoralizing low grade of a D- when it came to the state integrity investigation. As a result of all this, instead of being solved, we are just so much more divisive than before. Rabbit holes keep getting deeper and people's thoughts continue to wander. And it seems like people are forgetting about Lauren, who she was as a person, a daughter, and a friend. So much time has gone by and so much in the world has changed. College life in general has completely changed. I am convinced that my college experience and the experience of those who attended IU before me will never be comparable to what is happening today. There has been so much reported violence, sexual assault, and incidents involving drugs and alcohol at major college campuses that ramifications were inevitable, not to mention the changes schools have adopted due to COVID-19. College students today are just starting to figure out a new normal in terms of going back to school, and the concept of campus safety has been given a whole new meaning because of the pandemic. As the students arrived back to IU's campus this year, it was reported by the Indiana Daily Student that cases of coronavirus were passed around the Greek community like wildfires, as an overwhelming majority of fraternities and sororities had to quarantine. At one point in mid-September 2020, more than half of the Greek houses at Indiana were under quarantine. It got to the point where the university put out a statement saying they recommended that students living in Greek houses find somewhere else to live. A sophomore at Indiana University who was living in the Zeta Tau Alpha sorority told Sports Illustrated they were given the option to stay in the house or move out and get a full refund for housing. She decided to leave, and now she's couch surfing in Bloomington as she tries to find a new place to live. It's quite a juxtaposition that this is how students at one of the biggest party schools are forced to live compared to the story of Indiana University that I've been telling you. No more parties in crowded basements of frats with hundreds of people. No, this is a totally different experience. Of course, kids will be kids and find ways to get drunk and enjoy themselves, but now, and at least for the foreseeable future, things will be completely different. It makes me think, will this make things safer? Probably, although it doesn't change the fact that predators and dangerous people are lurking around Bloomington, but it might give students, particularly women, an upper hand in situations where things tend to go awry in an intoxicated state. I genuinely feel for the students today who are missing out on the most incredible parts of college and the memories made at some of these social gatherings, the camaraderie that is now non-existent. Despite all the darkness that was lurking beneath the surface at Indiana, I still had such an amazing time and consider myself very lucky. So what is this new IU like? A reporter from Sports Illustrated took a look into the changes happening around campus that is described as, quote, so completely different, nothing like IU students past and present have ever seen. Freshmen are having a difficult time making new friends and meeting peers. The dorms guidelines are strict. Students are required to wear masks to walk the hallways or in the bathroom. If a student tests positive for the COVID-19 virus, they have the option to isolate in the Ashton Residence Center or head home for a few weeks of quarantine. Dining halls, usually filled with students scrambling for a meal in between classes or chatting away in their first few weeks of college, are now empty. Students have to eat outside or back in their dorms. Prior to the 2020 fall semester, students were required to sign a commitment form, agreeing to health rules and regulations outlined by IU. According to this form, students need to practice physical distancing at all times and always wear a mask on campus. As of April 2021, the Indiana Daily Student reported that students are still not allowed to gather in groups of more than 15 people, whether inside or outside. Violations of this policy will result in authorities shutting down the gatherings on top of potential further discipline. However, many students are still trying to find ways to party, and due to an uptick in violations of this policy as of May 2021, IU is strongly urging all students and faculty to get the COVID-19 vaccination to hopefully resume a more normal campus experience come fall. The beloved Kilroy's on Kirkwood hasn't been open since March 2020, and as of May 1st, 2021, is finally reopening their doors, but with limitations. They released a statement that said, "When the pandemic hit, we closed our doors. We missed you at graduation. We missed Little Five. We missed your birthdays. Most of all, we missed you. We are making this statement to tell you that we will not miss another graduation. We are coming back." Some of their new policies include no walk-up customers to control the outrageous lines, and groups are given entry based on 2 to 3 hour reserved time slots. Kirkwood Avenue can still draw a crowd on the weekends, but mostly everyone is masked up. Business overall is down, and everyone is feeling the effects. According to the Indiana Daily Student, Kilroy Sports Bar, the bar Lauren was at the night of her disappearance, reopened in late February 2021 with major COVID precautions after being closed for almost a year. Similarly, patrons are encouraged to make reservations for tables. Table reservations begin at $100 minimum, and customers are not allowed to leave the group they arrived with. The Jungle Nightclub will remain closed until further notice to practice social distancing. Masks are enforced. Hand sanitizer is everywhere. It's hard to believe this is the same bar I used to see people throwing up on the floor in before taking another shot. People in the Bloomington community have expressed varied opinions about sports' reopening, and many were pleasantly surprised with the fact that it had been closed for so long. It's just mind-boggling. Sports was the epitome of our college nights, and now it's dangling by a thread. So will Indiana University ever be the same? It's hard to say. For better or for worse, this is our new reality. And what does this mean for Lauren and her story? Will this new reality dull her memory and make it more distant for students today, harder to relate? Everyone is so disconnected and dealing with more stress and anxiety than ever before. It's hard to think about anything but yourself and your own sanity, not to mention a terrible tragedy. How do we keep the conversation about her story alive when so many things are different now, especially as we mark the 10-year anniversary of her disappearance? The following audio is taken from an interview that Robert and Charlene Spear gave to the Journal News.
If I could stop time, I would stop time. I feel like everybody is sort of racing to that mark and not thinking about what maybe we can accomplish before June 3rd. So for me, I don't even want to think about June 3rd. I want to think about what we can do today and tomorrow and the next day and the next day. And hopefully that it'll be the day that we get answers to help us find Lauren. I don't want to jump ahead to, it's not something I want to celebrate. It's not something I look forward to. It's not something I want to talk about. So
it's not a marker that's important to us, really. It just, it illustrates how long it's been since we've seen our daughter. But, you know, every day is a tough day. I think June 3rd will be a tough day, but we just hope it doesn't roll into June 4th.
I mean, we always hope that there's a possibility that... I don't know.
We try to be realistic.
Yeah.
We do. We know that if she had the chance to come home or reach out to us, she would have done it.
Lauren's family has remained active on the Facebook group, providing official updates of her case, as well as their thoughts with nearly 93,000 members. They've been relatively quiet on the posting front, only reaching out to their followers on important dates. The posts are flooded with messages of positivity and love for the family as well as Lauren. Many people commenting that they pray every night for her to be found and pray that whoever is responsible is brought to justice. There are also a ton of comments from group members who are just as confused and hurt by the lack of movement and resolve in this case as the family. Some are messages of hope, some are messages of anger. Some of them don't even know Lauren, but they have a connection to Indiana or our parents. Reading through all the comments, a few in particular resonated with me. They read, "I'm a stranger to you and Lauren, but I think of her all the time. Still, her story changed how I lived my college experience. I had just graduated high school when this happened, and I made a conscious effort through college and law school and now as a mid-20s woman in the world to look out for women and be cautious on nights out. I want nothing more than good news for y'all, or at least answers. But while that may never come, please know her life and disappearance has not been in vain. It has changed the lives of complete strangers, states away, and continues to do so. Prayers and love for y'all." Another one read, "I still think about her, and I'm so sad that you don't have answers. I graduated from IU in 98, and I know so many of us felt a connection to her. It could have been any one of us, or our children. We continue to pray for your family." Another, "I so wish investigators would open the files so as to help you get some more answers. My heart breaks for your family. I went to IU and regularly went to that bar. It's so scary to think that this could have so easily happened. I will always hope that someone finds the strength to come forward with answers to what happened. Lots of love to you all." And a simple one that made me think of myself. "I never knew her, but I also will never forget her. Prayers to your family." Robert and Charlene Spear posted on June 3rd to mark the 9th anniversary of Lauren's disappearance. Their post was heartbreaking, but also very telling on their stance. They wrote, 9 years ago, Lauren vanished into thin air. It's as if it just happened. For 9 years, we've followed every lead that has come our way, all either dead ends or lies. Not one single step closer to the truth. Most of who visit this page already know Lauren's story. Do I think her disappearance was random? No, I do not. Do I think we will ever get the truth or find Lauren's remains? I don't know. Will we ever stop searching? No, we will not. Will Lauren ever be less a part of our family? No, she will not. We are all so fragile, this inner circle who knew and loved Lauren. No cure for the emptiness Lauren's disappearance has left in our hearts. So, for those responsible, how lucky you have been. 9 years of dead ends for our family, 9 years of freedom for you. It will not always be that way. I hope that someday, someone will have a crisis of conscience and speak the truth. If not, well, you got away with it, or did you? This means every lead and tip has been followed up and still no answers. It means still the boys with Lauren that night are refusing to speak to her parents in depth or provide any more information than what they have given. It means that every single day, the Spearer family has to wake up and relive this nightmare of not knowing where their daughter is or what happened to her. It means that Lauren's story has touched not only people in Indiana and New York, but all over. I try and imagine the burden of pain her parents are carrying with them, and it truly is unimaginable. Robert and Charlene Spearer have been very candid about the difficulties of moving forward in their life, like they are constantly living in the present but fixated on the past because they can't move on. They have stated in interviews that they'd be able to deal with what happened as long as they know. They just want answers so that maybe they can begin to heal. It's like Groundhog Day, but to the most heartbreaking degree. The part that haunts me the most is that her parents do not think this was random. In numerous statements to the press, Robert Spearer said he has his doubts about the boys she was with that night and the story they are telling. A lot of the times in cases like this, it is the most simple explanation for what happened, which would mean that a lot of the rumors circulating that she overdosed and the boys freaked out and got rid of her out of fear might actually be what happened. So where are the boys now? It's hard to say with certainty, but one can infer a decent amount from social media. According to LinkedIn, Jesse Wolf is working for a management consulting company in New York. Based off his job posts and their locations, he seems to have bounced around a lot. This is his seventh job since 2011 and in locations like Colorado and Las Vegas. I couldn't find much of a presence of him anywhere else. Jay Rosenbaum seems to be a little bit more stable, pursuing different entrepreneurial endeavors. Currently, he's titled as the co-founder of a sustainable food company. It doesn't seem like Jay is on Facebook, which isn't unusual, but I was able to find him on Instagram. I have a few mutual friends in common. He doesn't post much, or often, and when he does, it's skewed towards work and his food company. Corey Rossman has also bounced around quite a bit doing various financial and consulting gigs. For the last year, he too has been dabbling in the entrepreneurial space as the president of a company called Matson Monitoring. When I tried to click the link on LinkedIn, it brought me right back to Corey's page, and there isn't a ton of information on its operations on Google. Corey is on both Facebook and Instagram, where his pages are pretty much dedicated to his wife. It looks like they've been married since 2018. Nobody I follow follows Corey on Instagram. It seems like they're all just trying to live their best normal lives. When putting all of this together, I had my own anxiety to work through. I'm constantly questioning if I'm being objective and clear enough in telling the story with all the players and addressing the very real rumors and possibilities without bias. But most importantly, I want to be sure I was positioning Lauren in the light she deserves. I want her to be seen as someone who matters, someone whose life was important to so many people as a daughter, a sister, and a friend. The focus has become less on the good things Lauren did, like volunteering in Israel and working closely with the Jewish community at IU, to magnifying her actions this one night and letting people judge her character off that. I want to show how many people have suffered without her, and how many people who didn't even know her are forever affected. At the same time, I want to tell a cautionary story and give insight on scenarios that were all too common to hopefully enlighten people. When I think back about my college experience in comparison to today, it's almost like a dream world that exists in my head. It feels like a movie or something that was real for a fleeting moment. I survived, I had a great time, and I was so lucky.
It's really devastating how every year it gets less and less attention, starting from like hearing about it to watching my friends search for her and talk about it on the news and talking about it every single day, to then going on with our lives at Indiana, even though a few things had changed. I would say that the people changed more than anything, and that's really sad. And it's something that people are gonna have to like, that a lot of those, her friends and family, like, have to hold with them forever. I think when I first heard it, I was so sure that the boys were just covering their own tracks because they didn't want to look bad and they didn't want this. They didn't want, like, one little lie to make them look guilty and they didn't know how to handle it. I remember like I asked my parents if they would have made me lawyer up if I was the last person to have seen her. And it changed like a few times every time I asked them. I think they like said yes at first and then no. But I feel like there's not enough actual details out there for us that we all know. Yeah, I feel like there's not enough information about what happened for me to be able to really have a good guess. I feel like every time I say that it maybe it was the boys, maybe she was abducted. It sounds crazy to me every time, but something had to have happened. And I think it's always going to be like a memory. And every time I think about it, I get a little bit sick and nauseous that it's so that I personally or the people that I'm around have no idea. We don't know anything more now than we did that day. But life goes on and it's horrible for her friends and family. And it's just, I can't imagine whatever happened that night, what she went through. It's sick. But people still to this day will always ask me about her. And it's horrible.
In my practice, when I have worked with parents who have lost children, which is the most heartbreaking, unimaginable, one of the things that they talk about is, who am I now? You know, I was this person's mother. Am I still a mother if I don't have that child? In this case, people are still grieving, a lifetime of grief, perhaps if the person never comes back, because they do have a loss. But unfortunately, they will never know unless there's some definitive proof either way. Honoring your loved one who is maybe gone and maybe not, how do you do that? I mean, that's an individual choice. And grieving, mourning, and taking care of yourself in a way that you can so that some of the trauma is less intense every single day, even though your heartbreak is there every single day, is an individual choice. And there's no timeline. Nobody can tell you, you should be done with this now. It's been XXX amount of time. People put one foot in front of the other and try to find meaning and purpose in your life.
After all this time, I think that finding her might be the scariest thing to happen. If she is found, and if she is not alive, we will have to come to terms with that. All the possibilities and scenarios in our head are terrifying, and the unknowing is painful. But if she is found, the reality that she might have very well been assaulted or suffered in some brutal way would open up all these wounds again. Or, if we find out that she has been in Indiana this entire time, it would prove all of our doubts about the inadequacies of the Bloomington police. I think we would all be completely unnerved. I would be furious. On top of that, if she is found, will we be able to bring justice to her and her family? Will there be evidence found that could be helpful? And what about time? Time that we can never get back. The clock is always ticking. Parents' lives have been missing. A part of them is gone. And what is it to be missed? To long for someone's presence and energy that is just non-existent? I think we can all acknowledge how that feels to some degree. Lauren's parents, Robert and Charlene Spearer.
And you just don't ever know when it's going to overtake you. The missing Lauren and... the longing, you know, it's not... You really learn what that word heartache means because you literally ache. So... I think we're just kind of stuck in this place, and until we know something, I think it's going to be very difficult to go to any other place.
Right. We don't think about moving forward. We're just caught at a moment in time, and that moment just keeps getting longer and longer and longer. That's really that's the way I feel. I don't think about moving on.
There are so many emotions that are, you know, it angers me that, as I've said, somebody knows right now where Lauren is. It's just incredibly frustrating. I don't know what's going to make a difference. I don't know what it's going to take to get this person to finally say, okay, you know what, I'm going to do the right thing.
My intentions are to keep Lauren's story alive. From everything I've read, conversations had, and countless interviews I've watched, it seems the narrative has shifted away from who Lauren was as a person and become so much more about the Spearers versus everyone else. Negative comments have been made publicly back and forth by people and family of those involved. At the same time, the lack of information and the silence surrounding what happened that night has left us without closure. We're stuck in this loop. There have been so many lives ruined by this, including the boys with her that night who will always carry this association until their innocence can be fully proven. And how can it be when no one is talking? How do we break the cycle? We all have a role to play here, no matter how close or how removed. We have to keep questioning what happened. We have to keep remembering Lauren's life and her story and how it's been forever altered. We have to keep asking questions and being supportive. And we have to keep holding each other accountable so that we can one day find Lauren. Lauren Spearer's case is still an open investigation. Anyone with information regarding her disappearance, please reach out to Bo Deedle and Associates. For updates from her family, follow the official Lauren Spearer updates page on Facebook. Finding Lauren is hosted and produced by me, Kira Breslin, edited by J. Cody Spellman, engineering and original music by Monty Weber, logo design by Josh Stauffer. Special thanks to USA Today Networks for use of media. For links to sources, clips, and more information, you can follow at Finding Lauren Podcast on Instagram.